Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in show. I'm Ray Graff. Back from a very long sabbatical, today we convene the Science Forum as we have gathered a panel of experts to respond to your questions. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, you can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. Go to wamc.org/voxpop. That's another way. You can also comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. And then, if that wasn't enough, you could tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You know, you get 140 characters. So if you have a real in-depth science question, perhaps tweeting, not the way to go. But again, the phone number, 1-800-348-2551. And let's meet our panel of experts. Dr. Barbara Brabets is back, Associate Professor of Biochemistry in the Department of Natural Sciences at the State University of New York at Cobleskill. Barbara, welcome back.
Thanks, Ray.
And Dr. Nancy Slack, Emeritus Professor of Biology and History of Science of the Sage Colleges. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Nice to see you again. We'll talk about the Tasmanian Devil in just a moment. After we introduce a newcomer, Dr. John Delano, Distinguished Teaching Professor, Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and works extensively in the Chemistry Department at the University of Albany. John, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks, Ray.
Now, before we get to this interesting news about the Tasmanian Devil, John, why don't you tell us a little about what you are working on right now?
Yes, I'm working with a team of scientists at RPI, University of Arizona, Syracuse University, and Astrobiology, funded by NASA. Mm-hmm. Whole bunch of different great things going on in astrobiology. First, about a week ago, 10 billion Earth-sized worlds are now currently estimated to be in the galaxy.
Hmm. But not in the so-called sweet spot?
Not necessarily in the sweet spot, but buckle up, we're in for a ride.
Oh, this is exciting.
Ray, you're showing off your astronomy info.
Oh, well, you know, we have Bob Berman on regularly, and he teaches us.
But what's this about water?
Oh, yes, water on Mars. Water transported and water deposited sediments in the bottom of Gale Crater, soon to be drilled and chemically analyzed by the Curiosity rover.
But not a deep drill, though, just a couple of feet, right?
It's going to be a shallow drill. You're absolutely right. But nonetheless, it's going to be getting below the surface and getting some fresh, unweathered material and delivering that powder to the rover for a whole bunch of great tests about its chemistry and mineralogy.
Now, has this been done before?
No.
Digging below the surface?
No. So, not with this kind of capability. No.
If you had to put if you had to put odds on it, would you say there is a 1% chance that there may be some microbial life down below the surface of Mars somewhere?
Okay. I've already bet and put some money in an envelope and sealed it in a mayonnaise jar.
Yeah.
And I think that ultimately, not necessarily with curiosity, but ultimately my guess, and it's only a guess, I think the possibilities are promising.
Well, maybe I'll throw some money in the jar as well.
No,
I like this science forum, like pools for science.
We've done the gambling thing before on the.
I put my week's allowance, 25 cents, in an envelope, and I'm ready to go.
1-800-348-2551. Keep trying if the lines are busy. Now, Nancy Slack, you had mentioned the Tasmanian Devil, which I thought was really only in Looney Tunes at this point, but there's more to it than that.
Well, actually, we decided to start with some breaking news, so that's what John did this, and I wanted to tell you about the devils. I was telling my husband about this rare infectious cancer that Tasmanian devils, which are a kind of marsupial related to kangaroos, more or less, but they look like dogs, rather fierce dogs, and he said, Tasmanian devils are extinct. And I said, I didn't think so. I'd seen one in a wildlife park in Australia last year, although I haven't been to Tasmania. Well, they're definitely not, but they're becoming extinct, and more than 80% of them are now extinct on the island of Tasmania because they have this rare, actually contagious cancer, which they give to one another by biting tumors on their faces, and then some of the cells go into the bloodstreams on the animals, and they go from one to the other. And in Tasmania, except for one little section, a great many of them have died off.
Mm.
So the new news is that in big canisters, they have just moved 15 cancer-free Tasmanian devils to an island that looks like Maria but is actually Mariah, just off of Tasmania. And hopefully these will reproduce and form a population of cancer-free devils, and they won't be a figment of imagination for the next generation.
Has there been any research done, you know, in a way to stem the cancer? In other words, in a way that might help humans down the road?
Infectious cancer is extremely rare, but yes, they're trying to make a vaccine. But this cancer, like many, is mutating over time, and they're not all the same cancers in all these different devils. So this, as with flu, this may be more difficult than thought.
But by creating a population on an island, you're genetically isolating a population so they won't infect each other. That's really smart.
Indeed.
So let's hope this works.
Yeah. Well, we have a full roster of calls here. Let's go to the phones. Tom in Westerlo, you better turn that radio down just a hair, my friend.
I don't have the radio on.
Oh, well, turn something down. You're on. Go ahead.
Okay. It's your old friend, Tom.
Hello.
Mr. Ray Graff.
Hello,
who's,
Tom.
Who's pestered you for years about chemtrails.
Oh, yes. Well, let's get it started.
Well, anybody listening to my voice today can see Mother Nature in all her full glory. There's nothing but Mother Nature in our sky today. The problem is that more often than not, we are chemtrailed. And more and more people are aware of it. And what? I don't know if you folks are in a position where you can admit that it's going on. But I'm still just trying to put the word out.
All right, Tom, for the benefit of John Delano, who just asked me what are chemtrails, why don't you describe briefly, and I mean briefly, what you think they are, and then we'll let the scientists weigh in, and we'll move on, buddy, all right?
Fine, okay. I know what they are because I've looked into it extensively. When a jet leaves a short little tail that dissipates and disappears, those are ice crystals. That's what's called a chemtrail. A chemtrail is a mixture of barium salts and vaporized aluminum. It's laying across the sky, and then it fans out and spreads out.
Okay. All right. Well, let's let the scientists weigh in. Hey, Tom, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. Can you listen offline, off the phone here, and listen to the answer?
I can, but if anybody's actually willing to talk to me directly.
All right, go ahead. Barbara, sure. Give it a shot.
Tom, scientists are ornery folk. We really are, and we're skeptics. So the question in any scientific discovery is, what proof is there, and is it reproducible? So the idea that there is a vast scientific conspiracy to put barium and aluminum on the population which scientists live in is already kind of suspect from a scientific standpoint. The question is, why do you think contrails that are made up of mostly water vapor would dissipate over a short distance, but then the ones containing the so-called barium and aluminum wouldn't?
Okay. First of all, the amount of information online as to chemtrails and their makeup is extensive. It goes on and on and on and on. If the scientific community has never heard of them and is not aware of it, it's because they're not looking into it. I didn't say it's a conspiracy to prevent other people from knowing.
All right. Well,
we'll look into it.
Yeah, Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Layla in Mount Tremper. Layla, you're on.
Hi, I have a question, which is nothing as highfalutin as you guys opened with, but I have always been curious about, I've had male dogs most of my life, and whether I walk them for 20 minutes or I walk them for 2 hours, they always seem to come up with bottomless amounts of urine to mark things. And I don't know if, like, when they smell another scent, it stimulates the production of urine, or they just know how to hold back a certain amount, or what? So, I would love to know. So, if you can weigh in on that, that'd be
great.
We're
off to a flying start. Anybody?
I'd gladly take this one. It's a different kind of trail that he's following and one that he's laying. The social calendar, the Facebook of dogs, is definitely scent. So you probably take a set route every day, or?
No, actually, we don't.
Well, so even more impetus. If he doesn't smell his own scent, but he smells the scent of other females and males, there's a rivalry there. So he wants to make sure he can say, hey, dude, I was on this mailbox, you know, and I, too, lay claim to this territory. So it's a territorial response. Sure, you know, in the beginning, they kind of give it all they've got. And then towards the end, they're only giving little bits. The little bits that they're getting are there are secretions from the propucial gland. So they have sort of like a prostate-like gland that leaves a scent marker in their urine. So even if their urine is what you might consider new or newly formed, they're still going to say, hey, dude, I was here. And of course, their sense of smell is millions of times better than ours.
Right.
So you kind of wonder why they have to sniff you as close as they do. But at the same time, it means that you can smell scents up to 3 weeks, 4 weeks old. Mm. A friend and colleague of mine who's a scientist has an arson dog whose job it is to go and smell scents of accelerants left at a crime scene. And the dog has, we put scents down 3 weeks in the blazing sun, and the dog still made a motion that he could smell the accelerants at the same location.
And I just wanted to say that this has a long history, because dogs are all derived from wolves, and wolves lay down scent trails to mark their territories. And sometimes humans who want to live in cabins near wolves lay down trails of the same sort themselves.
Okay, that's a great spot to take a break. Layla, thanks a lot. Boy,
we're off. Time for a break already.
Yeah, whose idea was to do the science forum again? All right, hey, Zach, we'll be back one way or another.
Support comes from College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com. Maria College, Albany, New York, offering RN Baccalaureate Completion Program, Associate Degrees and Professional Certificate Programs, day, evening, weekend, and online classes. MariaCollege.edu. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080. And Albany Pro Musica, presenting the High School Choral Festival, featuring choruses from area schools, including Hoosick Falls Central School District and Shenandoah High School. February 1st at the Troy Music Hall, albanypromusica.org.
Well, the lockbox is open for business. The WAMC Fund Drive begins on Monday, February 4th, but you can do your part now. Get us off to a fast start. The WAMC lockbox, locks is something else. The lockbox is accepting pledges now. At our website, WAMC.org, you click on the lockbox, you can make a secure donation to WAMC. All the money in the lockbox will be added to the total on the first day of the fund drive, the WAMC lockbox online at WAMC.org. Now, I don't have an exact total, but as of yesterday, it was $160,000 raised. I'm sure we're doing moving along. If you want to help us, you know, heck, 160, that's a good day in the fund drive right there. So mm-hmm. We've already shaved off a day. If you want to make the fund drive shorter, get to the lockbox right now. We're back on the science forum. And Barbara, you have a thing you want to talk about.
I have a thing. Our natural sciences and mathematics department has been blessed with a new wing on our science building, which is officially open.
Nice.
Very nice. So along with the 6 new teaching labs and research facilities, our observatory is open. So we have already started research projects with students interested in astronomy. We're looking for extrasolar planets, probably the large ones, but we're still looking for extrasolar planets. And we're also working on a variable star project. We're trying to time the mutual orbits of 2 stars that are circling around each other and creating what we see in the sky as a variable star, one that goes on and off and on and off.
Ah.
A blinking star, if you will. So if you're thinking that those are the types of research projects you'd like to do, you may want to consider applying to SUNY Cobleskill in the fall and join our science program.
And I'm sure that the new faculty lounge is lovely.
No.
No?
What new faculty lounge? There's great lounges for students, though. We have the best view from any lounge in a science building in all of SUNY, I guarantee.
That's Dr. Barbara Brabich. She's Associate Professor of Biochemistry at SUNY Cobleskill in the Department of Natural Sciences. Dr. Nancy Slack is here, Emeritus Professor of Biology and History of Science of the colleges, Sage Colleges, I should say. And Dr. John Delano, the new guy in town here, Distinguished Teaching Professor and Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences Sciences. And that's at University of Albany, correct?
That's right.
And John has been with us before for a long period. But
it predates you, right?
Ah, well, and I've been doing the show for several years now, right?
Yes.
So, all right, well, good to have you back. So Barbara was talking briefly about finding planets outside of the solar system. You really can't do that with a telescope yet, can you? I mean, you have to map the brightness of the sun or the star in question, right? Or can you actually see some?
You map, as Barbara was saying, typically with university-grade telescopes, usually you map the brightness of the stars and look for blinking, very slow dimmings.
Right.
And that's when a planet passes between you and the background and the star that it's orbiting.
Oh, I thought you were talking about binary star
systems. We're doing two projects, one with two stars, one that goes from bright to brighter because the two stars kind of look like one star for a bit and then they go apart. And another one is looking for extrasolar planets by this eclipsing phenomenon that he's talking
about. That's right. And NASA has a spacecraft, Kepler, currently in orbit, that's using that approach. And it's detected thousands of worlds using that approach. So it works on the ground, just as Barbara was describing.
As long as the smoke plume from the furnaces of SUNY Cobleskill don't run in front of the observatory on a cold winter's night like last night. Yes.
Yeah.
But it's just a fancy digital camera that we have attached to an optical telescope. That's how we're doing our research. We don't want to make it super, super fancy because we want the students to be able to understand how A connects to B, connects to C, and so on. And they're doing the work. We give them the guidance and help troubleshoot, but ultimately they're the ones with the big aha moment.
So, all right. Well, let's go to another aha moment. And back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Aha, it's Phil in Little Falls. Phil,
hey,
you're on.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Yeah, good to hear from you. I mean, my question, I've been trying to figure, it's like, if you don't hear much about it, but you're talking about finding extraterrestrial life. I don't know, but let me get to the question.
Okay.
Then you can figure it out.
All right.
What it has to do with anything. It's like, they say there was an event 35 or so thousand years ago called the Great Encephalization, which involved the expansion of the head or the brain cavity, the cerebellum of the higher primate.
Okay.
And which I don't know if I thought of it or I read it, but allegedly or it's possible gave them the higher faculties that we have today of being able to be aware of our experience.
All right.
Cerebellum or cerebrum?
Cerebrum. I guess the brain.
Okay, so did this event happen?
Well, we know that the brain cases did get bigger. Our assumption was that there was some kind of cognitive difference that came with that. I mean, obviously, if your brain's going to get bigger in an evolutionary sense, there should be a reason. But our assumption was that Neanderthals, for example, which is another Homo species, that they did not have that same sentience that our caller talks about. However, recently we have evidence that they buried their dead, which other animals do not do typically, that they had ceremonial jewelry, that there was status and hierarchy within the culture. So anthropology, cultural anthropology, physical anthropology is really rediscovering, kind of connecting new dots together between the different Homo species that cohabited in Europe, even Homo sapiens and Neanderthals.
Yeah.
Cohabited at the same time and probably interbred. So we don't quite know if it's chicken or egg, or if the brain casing getting bigger was the birth of sentience. It may go back earlier to that.
Okay.
Earlier than
and
that.
Well, if you go back to other human ancestors, though, like Australopithecus, definitely the brain case was much smaller.
Much.
There isn't evidence that they could do any of these things. This was a recent very good film about Neanderthals, our program.
Yeah, was it Nova?
I think it was Nova. I don't think it was Nature.
Yeah, a series called Becoming Human.
That's right. Yeah, it was excellent. Yeah. It kind of did a good synopsis of the new Neanderthal discoveries that we found.
Let's go over to Will in Lenox. Will, you're on Vox Pop.
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question for your distinguished panel, and I think it's very admirable that some of the folks there are looking out towards other planets beyond our solar system. But my concern is taking care of our own planet. So I'd like to pose a question to the panel.
anyone who wants to handle this, or you can toss it around. This nation used to grow industrial hemp, and it was, in my opinion, was a good idea, and I'm not sure why we stopped, but I'm sure it's good for the environment and good for our economy. And I'm wondering if there's any support on your panel or any opinions
all
on
right.
that.
Hemp, anyone?
Yeah, I'm not a botanist. We all know that hemp has benefits as a material for manufacture of moccasins, shoes, ropes, etc. It's a political landmine, though, because of recreational use of marijuana. So you have...
Well, marijuana is a racist term. I prefer not to use
okay,
that.
Okay, all right.
Sativa cannabis, but
well, of course,
there are great benefits to it.
Well, there's more people on the radio than just you, so we need to explain it to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But you know, so if you can separate the two from a political standpoint, the science says that hemp is a product just like any others that could be agriculturally used.
And it is used in other places, but I think it's probably not economic to actually grow it here for these purposes.
Not in the Northeast, you mean?
Well, I don't know. Anywhere well, in the United States.
We appreciate the call very much. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We go over to Eric in Plainfield, Mass. Eric, you're on.
Hello, Ray.
Hello.
I'm so glad the Science Forum is back.
Me too.
My question pertains to my wood stove. I'm wondering if it's more efficient to make big loadings of it or numerous smaller loadings of it.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Gee, I'd like to know that for my wood stove, too.
Well, I'm thinking about my wood stove at home. You have one, Nancy, right now. It's so bitterly cold. I stoked it up before I came in, so we could probably have some when we get home. First off, how old is your wood stove, Eric? Like, does it have a catalytic converter in it? Do you know? If you don't know if you have a catalytic converter, you probably don't have one.
We do. They're quite modern.
Okay, so if you have a catalytic converter, then what that does is it reburns the gas if you have incomplete combustion of your fuel.
Yes.
So if you have a slow burn, that is a low oxygen state, it'll smoke more. That smoke gets reburnt in the catalytic system. Mm-hmm. That gets you the advantage of a slow burn. If you have a stove that's not as sophisticated, that does not have the catalytic system, then you would be wasting more than you're saving if you were doing a slow burn. So when you say a full load versus a small load, what I figure you're saying is a full load at a small burn or slow burn versus kind of a fast fire that you keep on restoking?
Not necessarily. My question was more about over the course of a day, would it pay for me to make many smaller feedings or one large?
No, I think you're better with the one large feeding if you have an ability to reburn the smoke as you would in a catalytic system.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. We appreciate the call.
And Ray, just as an aside, the catalytic systems do have a downfall. First off, they're more expensive to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is they're more touchy. They do clog up sometimes and get kind of kludgy. You really do have to watch them. They're kind of like the difference between a thoroughbred and a standard bred.
Yeah.
You know, the thoroughbred might be able to run real fast and do what it's supposed to do, but it doesn't have the temperament of a standard bred horse. So catalytic converter wood stoves can be problematic.
Okay, very good. Let's go to Dennis in Ellenville, I believe. Hi, Dennis, you're on.
Hi there. I'm not very familiar with the subject that I'm going to ask about, but I am curious. I recently come across a book that details something in human history referred to as the exogamy configuration. And I think your anthropology guest there might know what that
is. We don't have an anthropology guest. We're winging it here, Dennis.
Well, there was a question about anthropology, and it was answered, I think.
By Barbara.
Well, so I just thought
very well.
Anthropology.
All right, anybody have any idea what...
Say it again, slowly.
Exogamy?
Exogamy configuration.
I'm not familiar with it. Could you have a definition so at least we can use it from the definition standpoint?
You're familiar with the term exogamy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the practice of in ancient society and in tribal societies of marrying outside of the family group.
Yeah.
There's a number of anthropologists who have analyzed that you know, practice, and have kind of described it as one of the essential kind of elements in the transition from, pre-human evolution, the difference between the, you know, the apes and the humans, and the exogamy, the practice of exogamy, which is defined as the exogamy configuration, is what really kind of precipitated the change from a more animalistic family organization to a social family organization.
I don't think we can help you, but I'll take it home as homework. It's not exactly science, but perhaps.
All right, fair enough.
Include anthropology.
So on the next program, we'll give it a shot. I thought exogamy was, you know, you go out with your ex-wife for dinner, and you never know what could happen. All right, let's go to Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. My question is just with the respect to electric cars. I'm kind of wondering what there is about the electric cars that makes the batteries so expensive when they don't move. They're not mechanical as opposed to the combustion engines, which are large and heavy and have a lot of moving parts. What is there about the electric batteries that makes them so expensive? Are the materials hard to come by, or are they man-made? The guts.
Yeah, Jerry, the batteries that are currently being used in electric cars, as you probably know, are lithium-ion batteries. And those, the technology for lithium-ion batteries is a familiar one to us for small little batteries that go into our watches and cameras and so forth. But in order to store up a lot of energy, you need to make really big lithium-ion batteries, and that's a sophisticated technology, and it's recently been in the news. As you've probably heard, Boeing 787 is currently grounded worldwide
yeah.
Because of lithium-ion batteries. Those are big batteries because you have to power, you know, electrical systems.
And what's the problem with them?
There are a number of, that's what they're trying to figure out, is what is it? Is it a design problem? Was it a manufacturing problem with a particular lot of lithium-ion batteries? The lithium-ion batteries involve two kinds of solutions. This is very basic because my knowledge of it is pretty basic. Two kinds of liquids on opposite sides of a membrane, which allows current to pass through. And that membrane has to remain intact. If that membrane, that semipermeable, that thing that allows charge to go through, breaks, ruptures, those two fluids come in contact, and they will combust.
Interesting. And I guess, thank you for the call, Jerry. And I guess part of the problem is also temperature issues with lithium ion. Is it too hot or too cold that they don't like particularly
well? They aren't as efficient at cold temperatures, but they also do get hot as a process of this chemical to electrical conversion. I've had cell phone batteries. If you've ever had a cell phone battery that kind of puffs up, it's created gas, which is a byproduct of an unwanted reaction inside the battery. And that gas is very dangerous if it were to build up inside of an airplane, for example, and then do something, you know, untoward to the airplane. So.
That's right. So lithium-ion batteries had to get, as Boeing was designing the 787, it had to get a special permit. That's not exactly the right word. A special permit from the FAA to allow big lithium ions to be included on that aircraft. And
right.
They analyzed it and said, looks okay.
Right.
Well, we now know there's a problem, and they're being very cautious about it. But it's a very important technology, a very interesting one, but one that you have to be it's a more complex technology.
A dozen or so years ago, there was a fire on a commercial craft because they were transporting as cargo lithium-ion batteries, and they touched, got in series, and created a fire inside the cargo hold, and the plane actually was in jeopardy. So since then, you cannot take spare cell phone batteries with you in your luggage.
I did not know.
Yes.
Getting back to cars, I have a question for any of you. We've had electric cars since the time of the Model T. Did they have some different kind of battery?
Yes. They had the standard lead acid, very, very basic kind of lead acid. But, as you know, Nancy, very, very heavy, very simple, relatively simple technology, but very, very heavy. Lithium ions carry a lot of bang for wrong word. They carry a lot of oomph for much lower mass, and that's what makes them so valuable as for transport and for cars and so forth. They store a lot of energy. If you wanted to store the same amount of energy in a car, in a lithium ion, compared to the amount of energy in a lead acid, your car would weigh
all
tons.
The darn.
And
amazing.
That was the whole point, really, or
yes.
one of them of the 787, because you could use less gasoline.
Yes.
Now, the actual manufacturer, the materials that are in the lithium ion batteries, they do require some rare earth metals, but not a tremendous amount, but that has an expense associated with it. But we also have to think about the basic economics of manufacture. Combustion engines have been manufactured for 100 plus years.
Yeah.
The infrastructure is in place. In a sense, by charging what they can, but they're not even charging what it costs to build these electric cars. They're trying to recoup some of the research costs from the many, many years of research to get to the point that we're at. So those scientists did get paid, and now they're trying to recoup their money.
It is the Science Forum on WAMC. The phone number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Back for the home stretch coming up.
Support comes from Empire State English, Albany, New York, offering beginning through advanced English as a second language with private and group classes, including TOEFL. EmpireStateEnglish.org. Little Wolf Architecture, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing collaborative discovery and design for dwellings in the regional landscape, featuring passive house and natural home strategies. LittleWolfARCH.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop. And Bel Air Mountain Ski Center, now managed by the New York State Olympic Regional Development Authority. New York's winter snowpark, belair.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Science Forum. Boy, it's been a while since we've been here. Barbara Brabets, Nancy Zlack, and John Delano with us. Also our producer, Patrick Donjes, who has been fielding some queries on social media. Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, we've got a question here from Pooh, P-O-O-H underscore 35, and asks, why do birds sit on power lines?
Okay, well, anybody?
I think it's just a good place to sit. I mean, what other places have they got trees on power lines? They can look out and
buildings,
see what's going on.
Buildings, I guess.
Yeah.
And then hawks in particular like power lines because they get a great vantage. If you're a hawk that hunts by sight, you're in an open area usually when there's a power line. No trees or obstructions. You can see really well. I mean, mourning doves aren't hunters in that sense, but they sure like it up there, don't they?
They do, and also under my feet are about 10 at one time. But also, I think if you're not a predator bird, there's safety in numbers. So when there's 20 swallows sitting on a power line, they can warn others and perhaps keep them off.
Very interesting.
But interesting question.
Yeah, very. And thank you for the answer. Patrick Donjes, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. That's our producer, Patrick Donjes. John in Pine Bush. John, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi, I was going to ask a question about something I had heard. Dr. Tyson was the astronomer at the Hayden Planetarium.
Mm-hmm.
He was on a public radio program about 2 weeks ago. I heard an interview with him, and he mentioned something that kind of disturbed me. It was about the near-Earth asteroid program, where they're studying asteroids that potentially have the ability to slam into the Earth, so we're watching them. And he mentioned an asteroid that's supposed to approach Earth in the year 2029. It was going to come close, and then in 2036, there was a good chance that it was going to slam into the Earth. But what had disturbed me, he said that the scientists are well aware of it, and that they're working on different systems to be able to try to divert it. And I wanted to know if anybody had heard anything like that, because
I read a whole science fiction story about that.
I'm trying to mention that. Yeah.
All right. Anybody want to try this one?
Yes. Yeah, these are, yes, John, there are Earth-crossing asteroids, as you point out, that cross the Earth's orbit. We know of hundreds of them. And the one that you describe, what scientists are doing with NASA support to map the orbits of asteroids is to find out if there are any that threaten an impact with the Earth. So far, the answer is no. No large Earth-crossing asteroids, including the one that you've mentioned, will impact the Earth within the 21st century. And that's because NASA and NASA scientists, NASA-funded scientists, are working very hard to refine the orbits very accurately. Mm-hmm. So we can, they'll be coming close, but the coming close and hitting are quite different.
And I think also this is a citizen science program out there. NASA gives the sky data available to anyone who wishes to download it. And with some very basic math skills, some trigonometry, some basic algebra, you too can plot the orbits of the asteroids that are heading our way. And the scientists, that NASA really relies on the citizen science program to help call out those that are absolutely non-contenders and then kind of refine the data set down to the ones that need a closer look.
But is there some idea or possibility of diverting them if you get one that is going to hit us?
Yes, such strategies are being considered. Nothing has been tested in flight yet to do it, but yes.
John, thanks a lot for the call. And I think Bob Berman has addressed this several times on the Astronomy Show, and he's not concerned about this particular one.
No.
And, you know, one of the questions is, if you divert it, you better divert it in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, you know, or if you, this is why, I mean, we've had many callers saying, well, let's blow them up with atom bombs.
Yeah.
But then you have billions of pieces of this thing coming at you.
And no time.
Right.
And no time to deal with them.
Exactly. Let's go to Joe in Middletown. Joe, you're on.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's perhaps 10 billion worlds like ours out there. So along the theme of our search for intelligent life, is there universal support for that search within the scientific community? Or are there those who say we might just be lucky that no other intelligent life has found us, given the way we treat lesser life forms than ourselves when it comes time to mining and using up resources? Might it not be, even in a science fiction realm, if we were to be discovered by some intelligent beings that happen to value, for example, all of our water or something, mightn't they not just push us aside to get our resources?
I saw Star Trek like that.
Lots of science fiction about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, the Twilight Zone back in the 50s for to serve man was an interesting one.
Yeah.
The answer, I think in part the answer is, Joe, that the efforts that are being mapped by, used by NASA and other scientists to find exoplanets are doing so without emitting signals. We are measuring things coming to us. We are not broadcasting our presence.
But we have done that. I mean, we're broadcasting now.
Well, WAMC can be received on the moon.
That's
well,
right.
Plus, we have purposely sent out probes with little souvenirs in them and things like that. And
it'd take a long time to get there.
They've just left the solar system.
But keep in mind that we're looking for bacteria. I mean, we're really not looking for lions or tigers or you know.
Okay.
Dorothy. Yes.
All right. I think your question is a good one. And I seem to recall Stephen Hawking mentioning that.
Yes. But keep in mind that if anybody's if anybody really sentient and interested and curious and so forth is out there, they would need a technology that's only a few years greater than ours.
Yeah.
Five, to be able to know from their own planet that this place that we're on is crawling with life by measuring the composition of the atmosphere with their telescopes.
So will we know that in 5 years then about other planets?
Strategies currently being investigated by NASA to measure the atmospheres of exoplanets to see if there is life there.
It was only just a few years ago that we found the first exoplanets, and now we're actually figuring out, A, what they're composed of, how big they are, how distant from their sun are they. We're looking for that Goldilocks.
Yeah.
So it can't be too hot, it can't be too cold, it has to be just right for liquid water.
Now,
that's our assumption.
Is it possible that liquid water is not a prerequisite, and this Goldilocks could be in a much wider zone of a star?
And can you imagine imagine, can you imagine life without carbon? I mean, maybe you can, but, you know, we haven't got very far on that either.
Okay. Well, let's go.
Science is exploration, and that's and this is so much fun.
And this gets my juices going.
Well, all right. Let's go to Marjorie in Saugerties. Marjorie, you're on.
Hi, Ray. I'm so glad that the science forum is back.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. My question is, I have a stall shower, and the stall door has an open a space of about an inch and a half to 2 inches. When I step inside the shower and the hot water is on and the steam is all around, I don't have any difficulty breathing. I will wash my hair, do whatever people do in the shower. When I, if I shut the shower off before I open the door, it becomes very oppressively stuffy. And I was wondering what made that happen.
Hmm. Hmm. Is it stuffy before you turn the shower on?
No, no. If I'm, oh, before, no. No, it's not stuffy
so
before.
So say it's Sunday, Marjorie, and you need to go in and clean your tub. Okay, so you're not, you're in there. You've got to put clean shower or whatever on the inside of your surround. Is it stuffy then?
No.
Huh. And what do you mean by stuffy? Is it hard to breathe or what?
Yes, yeah. It, I mean, when I'm in the shower and the water is running and the steam is all around, it isn't difficult to breathe. But as soon as I shut the water off and I'm enclosed in this little shower compartment, it becomes very, very thick, very difficult to breathe.
Glass doors or a curtain?
Glass door. Mm. A glass door, and the glass door has a space of about an inch and a half, 2 inches at the top of it.
Well, so, you're not running out of oxygen, so that one we can rule out.
Atmospheric pressure?
There's plenty of space in there for you to breathe for quite a while. Humidity is a big issue. I don't know if you're asthmatic or if you've had any lung problems, but in highly humid days, if you think back to the summer, I know it's hard to think about that today, but we'll have heat advisories, right, where
yes.
It'll say the humidity and the heat combined, it's really not safe for people with lung problems to go outside. It could be, based on how hot your shower is, that that's the situation you've created for yourself. But I don't really have a good explanation as to... anything else
beyond that. It doesn't happen while the water is running.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to wing it here.
Circulating.
I'm just going to wing it and suggest that perhaps the stream of water coming from the shower is also stirring the air a bit. And as soon as you turn the water off, then the air stops being stirred and less air is being circulated from outside. That's
anyway.
Only I'm only guessing, though.
In any case, you need to open the door as soon as you turn the water off.
Mm. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Marjorie.
I mean, yes,
we'll see you during
a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll see you at the fun drive. Thanks a lot for the call. Jerry in Saugerties is on. Jerry.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, you know, the Storm Sandy certainly brought up the fact that the waters are rising, the glaciers are, you know, melting and all that other kind of stuff, and we have such droughts in this country in the West and in the Southwest. My question is, why aren't more people talking about desalination? I know that other countries do it. I know that it's very expensive. But just like the electric car, it eventually gets going. And I think investors would be interested because it seems to me a win-win on both sides.
Well, I it's a very timely topic. I'm teaching water chemistry this semester, so it's not all just about H2O, but all the other gunk we put in it.
Yeah.
There's really two things you can do with salty water in order to make it potable to humans. You could use a desalination facility, which essentially distills it, boils it, and then recondenses it down. So as your grandma said, a watched pot never boils. The science of that is really that a watched pot does boil if you put enough energy into it, but it's a lot of energy. And that's because water has something, a chemical characteristic called high specific heat. It heats up very slowly and it gives up that heat very slowly. But it takes the energy in when you do that. So distilling water, getting it to its boiling point and then recondensing it is energetically expensive. So when you think of that expense, not in a money standpoint, but an energy standpoint, you need a good source of energy or a cheap source of energy to make it worth it. So you have to be near a nuclear power plant, or you are in Saudi Arabia, where they use the, what they consider relatively cheap oil to make electricity to desalinate so that they can live.
Right.
So Dubai, that's pretty much how all of Dubai gets their water, Saudi Arabia, San Diego, et cetera. So if you have an alternative source that's not, you know, I don't know, photovoltaic cells or geothermal or something else, something that can get you to that point, then you can do it. The other issue, there's another form of cleaning up water called reverse osmosis, where we use a semi-permeable membrane, similar to what Dr. Delano talked about with the lithium-ion batteries, and you push the water through and you kind of skive out the ions. You get them to stick to the membrane and only the water goes through. But in that process, you create a super salt saturated solution, a leftover, and you have to do something with the leftovers. So that's not as energetically expensive, but it's more wasteful in the sense that you have to do something with the brine.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Sarah in Pittsfield. Sarah, you're on.
Yes, hi, good afternoon.
Sure.
I have a 7-year-old daughter who loves Legos, loves building things. And I was wondering, what can I do to encourage her into the sciences? And what might have you played with as a child or enjoyed that drew you to the sciences?
Hmm. Ooh, how about erector sets? Take her over to some real scientist and let her see what goes on in a laboratory. Even at 7, I think maybe particularly a biology laboratory, but any sort of laboratory, so she can see actual people doing real science. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can, I think these chemistry sets and such, really,
I never
really
liked the chemistry set because you couldn't blow up anything.
Back in the old days you could, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, it was very rated G.
Now they are.
At least by
third
grade you should have someone who puts some good science in the school.
I think if she has that curiosity, I think just feed it as best as you can. You don't have to be a scientist to turn your daughter into a scientist if that's what she'd like.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever it is, videos, books, field trips, ask her questions, and then have her try to solve them.
Yeah, and Lego robotics is a big thing in science fairs and in colleges and so universities. Great competitions. Lego robotics, outstanding.
Okay, Sarah, we're just about out of time there, thank you very much, and good luck with your daughter. Okay, here's one. We got a minute or two left here from Facebook. Christina on Facebook says, I want to know why we can't build floating platforms for the seals and such that are suffering due to the melting icebergs and ice flats. Seems to me we could do that with styrofoam or other things, and there is no reason that polar bears and seals should suffer. Also, why can't we float big, giant evaporation units to collect evaporated water on the oceans to provide plentiful, clean H2O, like a clear floating tent that has tanks for the water to run into? We have about a minute and a half here.
Wow. I'll take the water piece.
Okay.
Right now, we kind of most of our large cities centralize their water supply. They have reservoirs, they have wells, they have desalination plants. And so we think of it kind of like electricity, where we have a central location of production, if you will, and then a distribution network. I think if you decentralize water collection and water purification so that there are smaller, more manageable units, then we could take some of the technologies that the Facebook person talks about and make them applicable. But from a large scale standpoint, that wouldn't work because the chemical processes are just, they don't yield enough for what we're talking about on a large scale.
Mm. Nancy, what do you think about floating icebergs, styrofoam icebergs?
I don't think so in the Arctic. I mean, I can see how you might do that in some kind of wildlife park, perhaps.
Yeah, but sounds like a theme park.
The idea that you could put a platform that would survive the winter and all of that, that a polar bear would like and could still go finding seals, I don't know. It doesn't seem likely to me, but, you know, all ideas are welcome.
I mean, would that be something, you know, assuming that you figured out a way to make it last, would that be something that might work?
Except wouldn't the polar bears know where to get their seals? They just float over to styrofoam platform number 3.
No. Maybe transporting polar bears with the way they do with Tasmanian devils to a place where there's more ice.
Oh, gosh.
No. So we've come back, the alpha and the omega. We've come back again. You know, this was a very eclectic program, and we're just about out of time. Thanks to everybody who called in. Thanks to our panel of experts, Barbara Brabets, Nancy Slack, and John Delano for being with us. Sorry if you didn't make it through. We'll do it again next time. And boy, if we match the wide range of questions we had today. It's going to be another humdinger of a program. Support comes from Boyden and Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperron.com. Hildene, the Lincoln Family Home, Manchester, Vermont, historic home, Pullman Car, Museum Store, and Walking Trails, open daily year-round, 9:30 to 4:30, hildene.org. Cafe Capriccio, offering dining and catering with Tuscan cuisine in Albany, New York, and Neapolitan cuisine in Saratoga Springs. CafeCapriccio.com for reservations. And A.D. George Construction, for over 25 years serving the Pioneer Valley's residential construction needs, remodeling, additions, and more, from design to completion, 413-256-6752. Well, thanks, everybody, for being with us. That's it for Vox Pop. Zach Malloy was our engineer. Our phones were answered by someone named Matt, whose last name I don't know. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Stay tuned for a news update.